Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On this week's show, Sam and I officially and belatedly usher in 2007 with our top five most anticipated spring movies.
Plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by the Dark Horse Project, and the final film in our animation marathon, The Iron Giant.
But let's get started, Sam, with our review of Billy Ray's real-life espionage thriller, Breach.
You know why the Soviet Empire collapsed?
Good morning.
Godlessness.
God expects you to live your faith, Eric, at all times.
I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking for. The guy doesn't drink, goes to church every day.
Faith, family, country, those are the things that matter.
Come to admire him, I say.
Yes.
Respect him?
I never cared about making headlines. Wanted to make history.
He's a traitor, Eric.
My wife and I were driving out to the Mayfair Mall in Milwaukee last Saturday to see Breach, and I was happy to discover that I was actually looking forward to the movie. Then, Carrie pointed out that it was the first movie we'd seen in months that was completely unburdened by hype. She was right. Halfway through February, and I was seeing my first 2007 movie. Breach wasn't eligible for any Oscars. It hadn't been nominated for any Golden Globes. It wasn't on anyone's Best of 06 list. It wasn't so much that I was looking forward to the movie, it was that the movie didn't come with any baggage. Well, Breach takes place in the couple of months preceding the February 2001 arrest of Agent Robert Hansen, the most destructive spy in the history of the FBI. Hansen had been selling classified information to the Soviets for more than 20 years, had cost the United States untold millions of dollars, and was responsible for the deaths of at least two Soviet agents. Great character actor Chris Cooper plays Hansen. Ryan Phillippe is FBI recruit Eric O'Neill, the man assigned as Hansen's clerk, who helps to bring him down. The movie has been criticized by some for offering little insight into why Hansen, a professed patriot, practicing Catholic, and married father of six, did what he did. Some have suggested that the movie would have been more interesting if it had been told from Hansen's perspective. And certainly, you can understand their logic, learning as you do that in addition to his thrilling life of espionage, Hansen had a penchant for posting his sexual fantasies online and sending tapes of he and his wife having sex to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention a perfectly reasonable obsession with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes.
Adam, did director and co-writer Billy Ray make the right choice? Is his low-key approach to the material effective? And were you similarly relieved to be watching a movie unencumbered by awards hype?
Sure. It actually did feel good to go into a film that I had low expectations for, in fact. And I remember Matt Singer mentioned that he really wanted to see it. And I was like, really, Breach? You want to see it? It looks from the trailer just like your standard issue espionage spy movie. Yeah. I don't see why it looks that compelling. But then I read some interesting interviews with the guy who made the film, Billy Ray, and some stuff with Eric O'Neill, and all of a sudden I did get more intrigued.
And he'd done Shattered Glass previously.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an interesting film. And so I went in with a little bit of expectation that it would be pretty good, but really, you're right, no hype really behind it. And it's funny because you're right, I've seen that same criticism. People wonder if the film would be better if it got more into Robert Hansen's psyche and if he was the main character instead of Eric O'Neill, Ryan Phillippe's character. And I understand where that impulse comes from because he's certainly a more complex and interesting character, Hansen is, than Eric O'Neill. And of course, Chris Cooper is Chris Cooper. You are more interested in what he's doing as an actor than watching the sometimes bland mostly bland.
Let's go ahead. Sticks to him like glue.
Yeah. I can understand the impulse, but there's no way to know whether or not that would have really been a more interesting film. It could have been a worse film.
Sure.
And it's a movie we're never going to see, obviously. And I think that the O'Neill storyline is satisfying enough. And I also think that the Hansen storyline would really be a fool's errand in some way because it would be impossible to understand all of the contradictions and the motivations and the why he does what he does, that the movie does discuss.
This is a real character,
after all.
We don't know the answers.
And
we
that
don't
is the thing,
why.
Too. Yeah. Without his cooperation, without Robert right. Hansen himself actually breaking down for right. Billy
Writing
Ray.
Writing his memoir
why
we've all
did,
been waiting for.
Yeah, everything he did. There's really no way to tell, so I don't buy that criticism.
Yeah, I don't either. I really liked it, too, and I was actually surprised to find that leveled against the film. It was almost like they were trying to find something wrong with the film. I mean, this is a really, I think, well-executed movie and impressive for all the reasons that it's not. It could be any number of things, really sensational, and it's not, and I really appreciated that kind of restraint. And I ended up thinking, I think particularly as I look back to Shattered Glass, there is something about Billy Ray and with these two films that you really feel like, I mean, a lot of other directors, I think, are given credit for trying to re-embrace the 70s aesthetic in some way, or the kind of movie making they made. I really think both these films show that that's what Billy Ray in some way is trying to do, a kind of All the President's Men kind of film. He keeps things really simple. His casting, even. I mean, never mind Chris Cooper, who is perfectly cast at last in a kind of lead role. But all of the casting is kind of low-key, doesn't draw attention to itself, and it makes sense. Ryan Phillippe, as this Eric O'Neill, as this young agent, ambitious, but he's somebody, really interestingly, early in the film, he describes himself as, you know, saying, other people describing him
as
weak in some way, or that that he's a lightweight.
Yes.
And I was like, boy, that's what people say about Ryan Phillippe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it makes sense in terms of the casting. If the O'Neill character goes in to become the clerk of Chris Cooper's character, and he's just this like really brazen kind of guy who draws a lot of attention to himself, Chris Cooper's character, Hansen, is going to pick up on
that's
that
true.
In some way. It's really smart casting. Chris Cooper himself is fantastic. But what I really love is, as I mentioned, Chris Cooper getting a part that deserves the work he puts into all of his performances. This is the part he's been playing for like 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, the quiet, smarter than you think, kind of man in charge, very simple, falls into the background. Here he's in the lead, and he is outstanding. I know we've just finished talking about some of the best performances of 06. I wouldn't be surprised if this still winds up one of the best performances of the year at the end of this year.
Yeah, I had the same thought, and I love what you say about this film and Billy Ray being kind of this throwback director to these 70s films, because if you think about it, they are these films like All the President's Men, like 3 Days of the Condor, that are films that are really, they're spy movies, absolutely, but they're character-driven, and that
they're
really
bureaucratic
is...
bureaucratic spy movies.
Yeah, they are, and they're character-driven, and he understands that, and he really does try to get at the heart of what these characters are going through. And what I liked about the movie, you mentioned Shattered Glass, and I read somewhere where someone said, you're obviously into stories about liars. And he said, well, actually, Shattered Glass wasn't a film about Stephen Glass. It was a film about Chuck Lane. That's the way he sees it. It's a film about Chuck Lane's kind of redemption in a way and his dealings with the Stephen Glass character, this plagiarist for The New Republic. Chuck Lane, of course, played by Peter Sarsgaard and Hayden Christensen as Stephen Glass. And this film is, of course, more about the O'Neill character, as we've said, than it is Hansen and really getting at what he is undergoing. And I love that Ray shows that as complicated and grandiose and consequential, really, if you think about it, of course, the destruction that he caused, which you touched on, that Hansen, his spying, the trouble it caused, the why he did it, as best that the movie touches on it, is really no different than why Stephen Glass did what he did, which is the frailty of the human ego, the need to matter, the need to be somebody. And the teacher-student relationship here, there's this mentor relationship, is really fascinating. The way Eric O'Neill really starts to admire this guy for his convictions, for his intelligence, his understanding of how unfair the world is, it should resonate with really anyone watching the film. And it works because the writing's good. And in a lot of scenes, of course, you mentioned it, the acting, Chris Cooper, is amazing. And I disagree with some people who are criticizing Ryan Phillippe. I think here, I've always thought he was bland. Here, he gives a really mature performance. And unlike one of my favorite critics, David Edelstein, who says he's a really bad liar, I think he proves to be a really fantastic liar.
No, he's really good when
watching,
it counts.
Yeah,
absolutely.
When I was watching in those key scenes, like you said, when it counts, I was watching the scenes to see if you could get a sense of, was his heart rate going up? Was he starting to panic? Was he breathing heavy? Because if he gives anything away, there's no way Hansen is going to buy it. I didn't feel like Phillippe ever betrayed anything. I always thought he was really cool under pressure, was able to compose himself, and I think he pulls off a good performance here. And as you mentioned, Chris Cooper, he's able to make Hansen this complex and even semi-sympathetic character, despite being totally abrasive and abusive and bigoted and essentially antisocial. And I don't mean, of course, sympathetic like you actually care for him, but just sympathetic in that you find yourselves respecting him, just like O'Neill does.
And that's enough. I mean, really, all the criticism, I'm not saying this is a general criticism, just that it was a criticism at all, that this film should be from his perspective in some way. It's enough that he's an interesting, believable character. It's that he's complex. I mean, that was an interesting enough reminder to me that he is not a devil. He may have been the greatest enemy of the United States of the past half century, but that doesn't make him evil. It just makes him odd and conflicted like most people. And I appreciated that kind of reminder that these people are what make up our government, that make up our whole walk of life. These aren't superhuman people that are, or superhuman patriots. I mean, these are people that are fallible, yes, to pride or to money or any number of things. And I just found him fascinating. And I loved that they sort of left out kind of details, like I mentioned in the intro, the Catherine Zeta-Jones obsession. It's just out there, and it's odd and weird and real. And when he asks Ryan Phillippe, do you know Catherine Zeta-Jones? Do you know her? There is a moment where it's like, it's Ryan Phillippe saying, yeah, I know her. Yeah. But I do. I agree with Phillippe. I think he's really strong in those moments where he, you're right. You believe in Cooper's character so much that you know you're watching Phillippe as you know Chris Cooper is watching Phillippe. And I have to say, one of the faults maybe of the film is it sets up Cooper's sort of powers of observation early and often, that toward the end of the film, when he's not seeing when Phillippe is lying or misleading him, I kept waiting for him to kind of catch on with Phillippe, or for Phillippe to trip up in some way.
Well, I think he does, and actually I think it's another strength of the film that I think by the end of it, the movie wants you to believe that Hansen wants to get caught. I think actually that's the key scene between
them.
That
he's clearly falling apart.
Is that he knows
that
he's falling apart, and he actually does want to get caught, and it ties into this whole idea of penance and his Catholic guilt. So I think that that's there, actually, and not necessarily a fault of the film. I will say that I think maybe it sounds like I was less excited by it than you, because even though I did like it, and we really respect, I think, on this show, we respect filmmakers who take risks with genre, and he's done it. You mentioned your whole 70s analogy there, and it is great. And what he's done is he has stripped down that espionage thriller and made it this character study. And you watch the trailer, you think it's going to be this standard cat-and-mouse thriller, and here instead, we get people dealing with all these issues of family and identity and guilt and how you define yourself. And it's notable that the most interesting tense scene in the film is not a car chase, but the complete opposite of a car chase, a traffic jam.
That's right.
That really is, right? I mean, that's the tensest moment in the film, and instead,
well, that's the big payoff.
Cars are just standing completely still.
That's a great
point. He it's like he's almost playing with the genre a little bit, and I respect that and the challenge he's kind of taken on. But at the same time, I did find myself wanting it to be a little less talky and more suspenseful. Not necessarily action is what I'm talking about, but, you know, gunfights and explosions. But I did feel like there were ways to infuse more tension and to make it a little more suspenseful than it was. And I did find myself drifting a little bit as the film went on. I think part of it, too, is the score, which reminded me a little bit of a Philip Glass score, but a little more subtle. And it just makes things seem a little too sentimental and sappy in moments that it doesn't need to be. It makes it feel more, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of
conventional,
lazy
in a way.
Conventional, but just sweet almost in some way than this really tense kind of 70s thriller that the movie kind of wants to be. And so that did distract me a little bit. But on the whole, I was definitely into the film.
I was too. And my one criticism, and I think of it as a mild criticism, and it's something that occurred to me only after I saw the film, and it's that it always felt like a movie. At no point during the film was I like, that's exactly how it was.
Right.
You know, it feels like a movie. It feels staged.
Sure.
The scenes feel staged. The scenes feel scripted. And it's really well executed. The writing is good. The acting is fantastic. And the filming is good. It's not. It doesn't draw attention to itself like everything else. But I think particularly of the scene where Hansen's car is dismantled. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that looks like CSI to me.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't look like what it might actually look like. He doesn't want to create that illusion. And again, it totally works, but it's just like, I'd like to see Billy Ray as the director, if he's going to mature in some way, introduce a kind of improvisational, kind of real life kind of feel to his movies. I feel like maybe he doesn't take enough risks in that way, but I did admire the film quite
a bit. I think too, the last thing I'll say about Billy Ray is I think that just like with Shattered Glass, he tends to get maybe a little bit too preachy. And there are moments, even though the script on the whole obviously worked for us, there are a lot of moments in this film where he's really trying to hit home the themes and make it a character study where characters really say exactly what the text would be. There's no subtext at all. It's all very obvious. They are literally verbalizing the themes of the film. There's one point where his wife says she's trying to get some information out of him, and he's reluctant to tell her because he can't, because of course it's his job.
That's a scene I think
O'Neill,
a particularly
and
weak
she
scene,
says
yeah.
It's as if you think by telling me you're betraying your country. And it's like, we know that already.
Yeah.
You know, and there are a lot of moments like that happen. And there's one scene too with Ryan Phillippe where he goes to talk to his dad about this whole conflict he's having with work and his boss that feels like it belongs in another film.
It really does.
That really doesn't make any sense. But again, he's really trying so hard to hit home the themes of this character, Eric O'Neill, trying
and
to define
sense of duty
himself
and all
a sense
that,
of duty.
Yeah.
It just, you know, there is a moment where I really wanted him to just get back to trying to track down Hansen and figure out what he's made of. So,
but it definitely, as far as like we've been talking a lot about the fact that it's like there's nothing out there right now, mm-hmm. there's nothing to see. I think this is worth seeing, absolutely.
Okay, Sam, and how's Laura Linney?
I was going to say, how could this not come up? She's quite bad.
You think so?
Yeah, she is. Let me tell you, this is what I realized. She has a nice scene towards the end where she's like, I've got to get back to this, my laundry. Really nice scene. This is what Laura Linney does for me. I don't see her imagination at work at any point. I mean, with her character, what I see is what anybody reading the script would give on a first read-through. That is what Laura Linney does. There's no imagination here. I don't blame Laura Linney. I'm beyond blaming Laura Linney. I'm blaming the casting directors.
Okay.
The casting directors, there's the license they have that can be revoked. I understand why she was cast here. She is somebody that doesn't draw attention to herself. I also don't find her interesting in the least.
Okay.
And she doesn't make her characters more interesting.
She does play this character who is the person who gave Ryan Phillippe the job, the agent who's kind of heading up the case against Robert Hansen. I think she's more interesting than you, and I don't think she's bad at all. But I do agree with you that you're right. When you watch the performance, you realize that it's pretty standard issue stuff.
It's really
she doesn't
standard.
Make it any more complex beyond what's
and
on
I think
the
character would allow you, an actor, to make it more interesting. I think there's that freedom there where maybe there's less freedom with these other characters.
Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly of that first scene.
Okay.
I think of that first scene, and then I think of what somebody else could have done to make that more interesting.
Maybe someone like a Joan Allen in The Bourne
oh,
Identity,
come
Bourne
on,
Supremacy.
Seriously. It's the same part.
It is.
And Joan Allen makes it so much
more interesting.
Interesting.
Okay.
Great point. I'm glad you were there for me.
All right. Well, if you've seen Breach and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call and leave a voicemail, 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463.
When we come back, are you effing serious? Are you serious in saying that Babel is the front runner for Best Picture? Your Oscars feedback and more is next. Stay with us.
I saw your face.
Hey guys, this is Scott in Beaumont, Texas, a longtime listener. I'm calling because I'm angry with both of you, mostly because I really didn't give a flip about David Lynch's new film, and yes, I've been subjected to it, and I have three thoughts. A, that's 3 hours I'm never getting back. Second of all, I'm a happy person. Why, after seeing that film, do I now want to hurt myself? And third, which would be more pleasurable, watching that film or listening to the latest Kevin Federline album? And I don't know what the answer is. But sadly, this disturbing event has been scarred on my memory so bad that I can't stop thinking about it, especially, why are there people with animal heads walking around? What just happened? Where am I? Who am I? I don't know. But I'm thinking I'm going to have to go into therapy. I'll be sending Film Spotting the bill.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that's a voicemail from Scott. Chiming in with some thoughts on David Lynch's film Inland Empire, we read some of your listener feedback last week on the show, and most people were accepting of the film, enjoyed the film, but there were a few.
I think this film was kind of
self-selective
in some way, and I don't know what Scott was expecting, and that's the thing. I feel like you can make up your mind pretty early on in that film that this is going nowhere.
Right.
I am not having a good time. He stuck it out for the 3 hours. He's scarred for life.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's wondering if maybe time would have been better spent listening to Kevin Federline's. I don't know if he has a new album. I'm only aware of the Backup Dancer's first and only album.
Uh-huh.
I can't speak to it myself. Maybe it's worth exploring. And Scott, let us know.
Part of the answer there in response to Scott is that he doesn't know which one would have been a better use of his time. But he does point out that the film really is scarred on his brain and he's never going to be able to forget it. And I think that's what you expect out of a David Lynch
great
film.
Art does.
Sure, and it's certainly not a surprise that most of the responses have been positive because with this kind of a film, the only people going are Lynch fanatics.
Right.
So
they're
for
willing
the most
to
part,
put themselves through that kind of
we
thing.
Do appreciate, Scott, that you made the effort and went out and saw it. Let's go ahead and get to this week's poll questions. And, of course, Sunday, February 25th, the Oscars. We'll find out who will win Best Picture. And we were asking you on our website last week which film should win Best Picture on February 25th. Babel, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, The Departed, or The Queen? How did it come out?
Yeah, maybe no surprise. 59% of listeners wrote in to say The Departed should win Best Picture. Certainly one of the favorite films of the year from a lot of our listeners. 13% said Letters from Iwo Jima, 11% Little Miss Sunshine, 10% Babel, and only 7% The Queen. And this is, I don't know, I guess it's just the fact that everyone I've spoken with, everyone that's seen The Queen, loves this film. Best reviewed film of the year. Iwo Jima, that surprises me.
Yeah,
Iwo Jima is the only film I feel like doesn't maybe have a shot.
That's the film here, the vote that really was a surprise to me as well. Letters from Iwo Jima, even though it's only 13%, and you know it's kind of a
compared
negligible
to The Departed,
difference,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Still
true.
Getting the second favorite votes against Little Miss Sunshine and Babel, I really thought one of those two would be a bigger favorite among our listeners. But I'm glad to see it because I
love
too.
It's a really
Iwo
impressive
Jima.
Film.
It is a great film. So let's get on to this week's poll question. And it is the Oscars.
Yes.
We have to beat the Oscar drum just a little bit further here, and then we will move on, we promise. But I thought this was a really interesting question that you came up with, Sam.
Yeah, the Oscars. I'll watch, and I hope they get it right. I'll watch, but I know they'll get it wrong. I'll watch Ellen, or I'll watch When Hell Freezes Over, because there are those people out there that just think that they were betrayed maybe early and often and really had a stake in these things. But really, come on. It's a dog and pony show.
Yeah,
enjoy it.
So where are you voting, Sam?
Oh, well, I'll watch, and I hope they get it right.
Yeah.
Honestly, I've got enough stake in enough of the categories, maybe not so much Best Picture, although, yes, I'm rooting for Babel, but the actor and actress and even the supporting actor and actress categories are chock full of great performances.
Yeah.
I'll be happy to see somebody.
Yeah, this is one year that I can't be that cynical. I'm with you. I'm hoping they get it right because I looked at my picks for who I thought will win a lot of the categories, and they perfectly coincide with who I think should win.
Yeah.
Mirren, Forest Whitaker, Jennifer Hudson, and hopefully The Departed. So I can't really be, as I said, too cynical about it. We'll wait and see. And actually, I will be watching the Oscars, it looks like, Sam, on Sunday with one of our listeners inviting me to their party here in Chicago.
How about
if you want to get
exclusive.
Adam Kempinar live and in the flesh, you know, I'm bringing the kids.
Yeah.
I'm bringing
oh,
the
really,
kids.
The
I'm bringing
gang.
The wife. You invite me, you get everybody. I may bring the dog. I'll let you know how the party goes next week on the show. And again, of course, if you're
That's
hearing
exciting.
This post-Oscars, we'd still like to get your vote in the poll. You can tell us which one you did as you watched the Oscars. Were you cynical? Were you positive about it? Or did you not watch at all? And did you love Ellen DeGeneres, which
I'm looking forward to it. I've always liked her. What are you, crazy?
No, I'm not.
She's great.
Okay. Well, let's move on then, Sam. We have a few notes we want to get to before listener feedback and we get into the mailbag. We want to re-mention the fact that we have a Dope Sheet contest going on right now. If you sign up for the Dope Sheet, it's our weekly email sort of newsletter. You sign up for that by March 1st. One random subscriber will get a new iPod Shuffle engraved by Film Spotting, and a second winner will get Idiocracy on DVD. So thanks again to Alex Nesnick, our message board's moderator, and also Paul Symptoms of Majesty for
yes.
chipping in those prizes. And the Dope Sheet also, we want to mention, if you're a subscriber, and many of you are, it's going to start going out on Monday. We tried this once before and we didn't stick to it. It's been going out late in the day Friday. We really want to send it out Monday morning, looking ahead maybe to the week a little bit. So we're going to start consistently.
The subtext there is Sam always finishes the Dope Sheet late.
That's true, but I'm not really any earlier than you. So
that's true.
We should also really quick thank Jeff Houston, our listener and our Dope Sheet editor, does a fantastic job of the last four or five Dope Sheets and really has been indispensable. So thanks, Jeff,
and
for
moderating
all your help.
A bloody battle that we're waging.
If
over
you are
blood
just
diamonds.
Now subscribing, you really missed two, I think, pretty fantastic editions of the Dope Sheet. Actually, at least one of our listeners in our message boards, though, was upset. They think everything isn't right in Denmark between
yeah.
Sam and
well,
Adam.
Well, we can still
Mommy
sit across the table
fighting.
From each other and be peaceable. But
yeah.
when it comes to the Dope Sheet, the knives are out.
That's true. We're not across from each other. We can say whatever we want, so that's interesting. Also, programming notes. Chicago Public Radio, as you know, we have a show on the last Saturday of every month. That's the way it has been. It will now be the last Sunday of every month at 9 p.m. We're just letting you know, but we're actually going to move to a new day for the podcast, all our shows, all of them. There won't be any more gaps where one show's on Wednesday and then one's on Saturday or Sunday. All of them will be up on Friday morning, and this makes sense for us because movies obviously open on Friday. It gives us a chance to review movies that might be opening that day if we were able to get to screenings early, and it may actually happen with Zodiac. We're
next
hoping
week,
to get
yeah.
to advanced screenings, critic screenings, and then have a review of Zodiac up the day it opens March 2nd. So look forward to that. Also, a movie like Spider-Man, of course, a big event movie. We want to be able to review those movies the day they open, and so look for those shows on Friday. And also, you may have been noticing, and hopefully you don't mind, though I know many of you do, the shows have all been more consistently around a 60-minute mark lately, and that is going to be consistently the way it is, because our shows are now being made available on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, which means your local NPR affiliates can pick the shows up. This is in conjunction with Chicago Public Radio, but in order to be syndicated, the shows have to be the same length every week, and so we'll be consistently turning out 59, 60-minute shows, and again, hopefully that isn't a big deal for those of you that love it when we go on for 85 minutes.
Including the outtake, though, so
that's
really
true.
That's always a bonus.
That is a bonus. And speaking of PRX, we want to mention, if you want to help get Film Spotting on your local station, just go to filmspotting.net. You'll see a button, a graphic that you can click on with more information about how to contact your local affiliate and where to direct them to get more information about Film Spotting. Last note here, Sam. I was in New York City over the weekend. Want to thank the listeners that came out and met up with Matt Singer, Rachel, Sam, Darby, Steven, Travis, and the one and only Film Spotting contributor, Maddie Ballgame.
Mr. Maddie Ballgame.
We saw Factory Girl and had a few pints after that. And Rachel.
Rachel Falk.
Rachel Falk. I met up with her last time, too. She's one of the people that came out when we saw Brick, had a few pints then out in New York. She decided this time she was sneaky. She was like a ninja. When the check came, rather than letting me whip out Film Spotting credit card.
Yeah, really.
The Film Spotting,
this is on Film
Platinum
Spotting
card.
The Platinum card.
She had already sneakily put her card in there, and she paid for everything.
That's incredible.
It's
well,
ridiculous.
I'm glad you let everyone know. Yeah.
I hope she knows how mad I am. So, okay, well, let's get on to the mailbag here, Sam. And why don't you start with this email from listener Scott Larson, even though he's going down a familiar path here with some anti-babble venom.
Outraged, Scott Larson. Yes, subject line, are you effing kidding me? Are you serious in saying that Babble is the frontrunner? I know it might win as a political statement about misunderstandings causing international conflict, but that being said, it was completely preachy and obvious in its motive. The story was designed around one political statement, and the story felt forced at best. If it wins, it is to give a giant FU to President Bush, not, I repeat, not because it is the best film. The best film out of the nominees is The Departed, Scott Larson writes. I'm sorry, has a problem with relevancy, apparently
or
really good filmmaking, I guess. Yeah, apparently Bush is against that as well, really good filmmaking or relevancy. I don't know. I don't understand that comment. Scott Larson, you did actually write back and correct him, because I think he was misunderstanding.
He was
us.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I said I think it's the front runner, and I still kind of pessimistically think it could win, even though I picked The Departed. But it is a case where I'm just saying what I think will win. Obviously, I don't think it should win, and pretty much I agree right down the line with everything Scott Larson said. So
even if he is
can't
wrong,
argue right. with that a little bit. Even if he is wrong, Sam, that is the beauty of this. And let's read this one here quickly. Some more Oscar thoughts from Dat Nguyen. I don't think it's the same Dat Nguyen who used to play for the Dallas Cowboys.
Probably not.
He writes in and says, I think Michael Caine should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor for The Prestige or Children of Men. The man fits perfectly in any role you throw at him. Without his support, I don't think those movies are as good as they are. I don't
That's
disagree.
A good point. I
disagree. Think he's great in both
it's
of
funny,
them.
He didn't come up on either of our lists as far as Best of the Year, but he's always good, and maybe we're overlooking it. I have to say, I liked him more in The Prestige than mm-hmm. Children of Men. I wasn't quite buying him as this kind of hippie kind okay. of character. I just, it wasn't that he was bad. He's never bad. He's Michael Caine.
Yeah.
He's Michael Caine, actually. But I did really like him in uh-huh. Prestige, as I like the movie. Again, overlooked.
Okay. Well, let's read this last email here, Sam, from Brad Backofen in Chicago, Illinois. He's got some thoughts on Spirited Away.
Yeah, Brad writes, I'm a longtime fan of anime and thusly a longtime Miyazaki fan. The two are pretty much mutually exclusive. I first saw Spirited Away in its original limited release and remember enjoying it, but then found myself forgetting why in the weeks that followed. This has never really happened with his other films such as Nausicaa, Castle in the Sky, My Neighbor Totoro, and Porco Rosso, all films that I hold in extremely high esteem. Listening to your review, however, did influence me to pop in my DVD copy and give it another viewing, and while I can't say that I really put it above any of the aforementioned Miyazaki classics, it does stand up on its own as a fantastic piece of cinema and was rightfully deserving of its Academy Award. It deals with the familiar Miyazaki-esque themes of flight, nature, and isolation in a way that's not only brilliant from an animation standpoint, but provides us with another glimpse into the imagination of a true cinematic genius. I guess the fan in me only wishes that from a mainstream critic standpoint, that this wasn't the film that is most associated with Miyazaki. I think something we can both agree on.
I think a lot of listeners agree with that. I know you agree with it because you definitely love Porco Rosso, but as I have to admit, I have only seen Spirited Away. I can't compare it to the other ones, but I know that I can only be excited about seeing them if everyone seems to think there are other ones that are better. How much better can it get? Spirited Away
better.
Was very good.
I know it was.
Okay.
Well, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, another round of Massacre Theater, minus the posh accents, and we'll discuss the movie one of our listeners calls the best American 2D animated film in the past 10 years. Stay with us. Time now to discuss what's new on DVD, brought to you by PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
A couple notable releases. Last week we touched on Babel,
the great Babel
nominee.
Ever.
Sam loves it. It's out on DVD now, as is The Prestige, a movie we both really liked, and another movie we both really liked, Shut Up and Sing. If you want to know what all the Grammy fuss is about with the Dixie Chicks, you can get Shut Up and Sing, Barbara Kopple's documentary, and check that out. But this week, Sam, speaking of our documentaries marathon, Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back, the deluxe tour edition. It's a two-disc set, commentary by Pennebaker, and then it has a second disc with a whole new version of the film compiled from over 20 hours of never-before-seen footage. Sam, I have a feeling you're going to get this, and you're going to go over it like the Zapruder film.
I'm going to live with this film. Yeah, this is going to put me to bed every night. This is incredible.
So that is out now. Also out, Tenacious D in the Pick of Destiny, and A Good Year, the Ridley Scott, Russell Crowe film, two movies we missed from 06, and Tideland, the Terry Gilliam flop slash fiasco slash disaster.
Widely reviled.
Yes, it was. But one of our film spotting listeners and the people we admire, Ryan Johnson, the director of Brick, he said on our big show, end of the year show, it was one of his top two films of the year.
Yeah, so, along with The Fountain,
yeah, you can check out Tideland and see if Ryan Johnson is crazy or not.
Tell me, what was Greta Garbo really like? Did you get to know her?
Oh, yes, I did, actually. She's coming to stay with me next month.
Oh, your finest.
Tell me, how much longer are you going to go on making films?
Well, I suppose that rather depends on how much longer the public want to see me in them.
Yes, it must be hard to know when it's time to throw in the towel. What a pity about that last run of yours. What was it called? The Dodger.
The Lodger.
And it must be so disappointing when something just flops like that.
Yes, it is. Rather disappointing.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Last week, Adam and I massacred Gosford Park, a tie-in with last week's special Oscar preview. Gosford Park won Best Original Screenplay Oscar in 2001. We told people it would be hard. A lot of people said, you call this hard?
Yeah.
Taunting us.
Though it was a case where we got half the number of entries from the previous week. So,
all right. Well, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Andy Swinarski in Danvers, Massachusetts. MA is Massachusetts, right, Sam?
Yeah, okay. That's right.
So congratulations, Andy. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Margot just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
We're on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it ties in with this week's top five spring movies, most anticipated movies coming out over the next few months. And so, fair to say that the film we will be massacring directly connects to someone we'll mention in the next segment.
Well done.
I don't know that I can put it on a platter any more than that. Let's do it. And once again, it gives Sam a chance a little bit to show off. I don't have the strength for
it.
I'm going to let you have the meatier part.
Okay.
You're the better actor. Let's run with it here. You start. I'll give you the action. And action.
You know this isn't going to have a happy ending. It's not possible.
Hey, man, we catch him, I'll be happy enough.
If we catch blank and he turns out to be the devil, I mean if he's Satan himself, that might live up to our expectations. But he's not the devil. He's just a man.
You know, see, you bitch and you complain and you tell me these things and if you think you're preparing me for hard times, thank you, but...
But you got to be a hero. You want to be a champion. Well, let me tell you, people don't want a champion. They want to eat cheeseburgers, play the lotto, and watch television.
Hey, how did you get like this? I want to know.
It wasn't one thing. I could tell you that. and scene.
So I'm wondering how this character turned into
Jack
Clint Eastwood.
So Clint Eastwood, you're
mixed
right,
with Jack Nicholson, but
and
that is
Christian Slater,
the scene. Yeah.
Oh,
so
I know, I could feel it.
Yeah,
I could feel it becoming. Oh, I was on a roll there too.
You were a little bit, but kind of confusing.
If you could have heard what was in my head, mm-hmm, masterful.
Would have been perfect. Well, if you know what film we really did truly massacre, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show.
Oh, here. This guy is Superman. Sure, he's famous now, but he started off just like you. Crash landed on Earth, didn't know what he was doing, but he only uses his powers for good, never for evil. Remember that. Oh, that's Atomo, the Metal Menace. He's not the hero, he's the villain. He's not like you. You're a good guy. Like Superman.
Superman. That's a clip from the movie The Iron Giant, directed by Brad Bird, famous for The Incredibles. The film is loosely based on a 1968 children's book by Ted Hughes, set in the 50s and in a little town called Rockwell, Maine. Centers on a young boy named Hogarth who meets this Iron Giant, a robot he calls him, who crash-landed from outer space, and they befriend each other and try to keep the giant from being destroyed by the U.S. military, thanks to a paranoid government agent named Kent Mansley. Think Fox Mulder by way of Walter Peck from Ghostbusters, and you might have an idea who Kent Mansley is. And Sam, we started our animation marathon with a pretty straightforward non-Japanese film, Watership Down, and then got lost for four movies in the anime world of starving children, government mind control, and ethereal spirits. We're now back on Western soil. Are you happy to be back?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a film you and I have discussed. We've always wanted to see it. A lot of my friends had recommended it, really loved this film. I was looking forward to this film more than anyone, more than any other film in our marathon. And I did really like it. And I have to say, if its power was diminished at all, it's only the fact that we just spent some time with Miyazaki, mm-hmm, the undisputed master of animation. And I found myself missing him a little bit, specifically just the organic look of the animation, of Miyazaki's animation. There's something really kind of hyperkinetic and very, very Western in terms of the way these characters move in Iron Giant, particularly early on. I found myself sort of thrown off by the look of the film.
Not as graceful, maybe?
Well, it's not as graceful in some way, yeah, where Miyazaki has this real sense of gravity in, mm-hmm, some way. And in this film, you have characters kind of, you have the boy, the young boy character kind of leaping out of his window onto a tree and then onto the roof in a very sort of unnatural way. And again, it's unfair to criticize. It's a cartoon. It's a fantasy. I know, but I found that the movie was, you know, it is depicting a kind of reality in some way.
Sure.
And I felt like undermining reality in that way. I was like, Miyazaki never would have done that. That, mm-hmm, being said, like the animation's incredible. The story I found really powerful, but the monster himself,
yeah,
the Iron Giant, I really feel fair in saying that this is maybe one of the greatest characters ever invented.
Really?
Just not only how it's imagined visually, but just the way it plays out, the relationship he has with the boy, mm-hmm, but really the way it's imagined visually. I was just constantly astounded by what we learned about this creature, mm-hmm, and how he came to life. And I found it really moving, the whole story of,
yeah,
the Iron Giant. Again, this really powerful, possibly destructive being that has this sort of gentleness to him, obviously,
yeah,
but only responds to fear, to attack in some way. And again, I really liked the way the movie handled the message.
Mm-hmm.
It's a message that we're familiar with, certainly, in terms of how we treat outsiders, something new. But the stakes of the movie, by the end, the fact that really it came down to everyone possibly losing their lives,
sure,
in a devastating,
yeah,
atomic attack. That really, really raised the stakes to the point where, yes, it's a message I'm familiar with, but I found it really, really powerful.
Yeah, no, I did too. I really enjoyed the film. It lived up to my expectations. And it's interesting that all six of the films we watched in this marathon can be appreciated mainly by adults, despite the fact that they're animated. I think really almost solely by adults. Even a film like Watership Down, it's probably the most kid-friendly we saw, but it's very violent. And this is the first film we saw where both adults and kids can enjoy it, which isn't alone necessarily a strength of any film, but I really found that interesting that it's kind of a preview of what you would get from Pixar, or, of course, Toy Story was 1995, but these films that both adults and kids can simultaneously enjoy. And I watched it with my soon-to-be 5-year-old son. First movie ever for film spotting I could sit down with my son and watch. And we watched this film, and he was totally engrossed in it, full of questions about it. Woke up this morning, actually, talking about it. It was funny, Sam. My wife came home from work, and the first thing out of Holden's mouth when he woke up was something about the giant flying up in the air and a missile. And Sarah had no idea what he was talking about. She thought it was a bad dream or something, you know, and then she realized, it was the Iron Giant. So that was interesting. It was a lot of fun to do that. And, you know, I'd put it up there with a lot of the 3D stuff. We read that quote from our listener, Mike Perez, who said that, you know, he hopes we enjoy this film. It's the best 2D animated film in the past 10 years. And I'd put it up there with any of the 3D stuff we see from Pixar, like Toy Story and Finding Nemo. Incredibly moving, powerful, and it is this political statement film. There's no doubt about it, like all these films we've seen in the marathon where it's against violence and against war. But it's not so much against the idea or the concept of the government or military in general, but just fanaticism and the perils, really, of paranoia that you see in this Kent Mansley character. And it isn't focused, just like with Miyazaki. They never lose focus and get too centered on the political statements. They know at all times, Brad Bird knows that this is, you know, a entertaining film. He's trying to move you. It's E.T. in a lot of ways.
Oh, sure.
But it's unique enough, or it is unique in its setting and in its characters, that didn't bother me. In fact, it just made me nostalgic for E.T. And I think that nostalgia is one of the reasons why this film really works. Brad Bird clearly does, despite the fact that he's dealing with these heavy themes and the paranoia of the time in the 50s with McCarthyism and the Red Scare and Sputnik and all that stuff. He clearly has a nostalgia for this time and place. It is called Rockwell, the 2D animation. He could have used 3D. He clearly didn't. I think there's a lot of that kind of paying homage to his predecessors and where we've come. And I found the film a really sweet, nostalgic film.
Yeah, it was really personal in some way, and I think the film starts with this old school Warner Brothers logo, and he is absolutely trying to evoke that time. And you feel like it is personal in the way we see some of these nuclear scare mm-hmm. videos in the classroom,
yeah.
And it's wonderfully imagined and also really beautiful. I mean, we're coming out of this Miyazaki with Spirited Away, our discussion of Spirited Away, and some of the shots in this film are just startling works of art. I mean, I think of the mom standing in front of her car on a foggy night. You feel like the movie slows down and we're just supposed to drop our jaws in awe, and it doesn't slow the film down in some way. For a film that is sort of hyperkinetic, it is really willing to slow down and take its time, and it does a great job of introducing these characters that are cartoonish in some ways. You mentioned Kent Mansley, this character that manages to be both buffoonish and a genuine threat, a real genuine threat.
Yeah.
And the boy is full of sort of the resourcefulness, but also this sort of kid-like pranksterish nature. I mean, they're all really well-developed characters. And again, I really think it makes the whole message of the film really effective. And I think the favorite films of this marathon, The Grave of the Fireflies, Spirited Away, and now this, again, it's their ability to handle the message instead of just hammering
yeah.
your head with it. And I think they deal with them in different ways.
Sure.
I mean, Miyazaki is much more comfortable working in this sort of metaphorical realm in terms of dealing with nature. Grave of the Fireflies used really kind of stark realism in its depiction of this young brother and sister. And here we get just more of a fanciful feel, mm-hmm. Whimsical kind of feel that, again, doesn't undermine the message at the
end.
No,
it doesn't. And again, you talk about the message, it never gets burdened by it, but I would love to play a clip here, but I don't think we're going to have time for it. But there is a scene in the film where Kent Mansley talks, and I'm telling you, I'm shocked that this film was made in 1999 when it was, because it could easily be a film that you could see being made now
in terms of its
relevancy,
yeah. Yeah.
Where he talks about the fact that whatever that object is, it's not American, so it's a threat, and we need to know what it is. And I'm not sure that that's far off from where we are sitting right now in post 9/11.
I would say it's more so.
It is, by going back, you know, by looking back at this time in American culture, he's managed to be really prophetic, looking ahead to where we are right now. Maybe again, it has to do with that idea of kind of history repeating itself, and maybe Brad Bird knew that, or it was just luck, serendipity.
Maybe it
but
was
whatever
an unfortunate
it is, the,
serendipity.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly,
but
yeah.
The film really works. We had a lot of fun with it.
We did. All right. Well, next week we'll hand out the Harryhausens or something. We're still coming
thinking
up with the
about
name.
The Harryhausens.
Our best of the animation awards, and take a look at our next marathon, which will be silent films.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we return, Sam and I get in a hot fuzz over some of the new films coming out before summer. Our spring 2007 preview is up next. Stay with us. Sam, we also want to take a moment to thank everyone who was very generous last week. They went to the filmspotting.net site and clicked on one of the PayPal links and threw a few bucks our way. Who would we like to thank?
Well, first, let's thank the Gold Club members. This is a very exclusive club. Alexander, I think we've given him the nickname already, the Burn Redeemer, but we've given him another one as well, Upsetting the Applesauce. That's Alexander, the Burn Redeemer, a.k.a. Upsetting the Applesauce. Also, John, Prevent No Apparitions, and Holly, Lavender Royalties, all gold members. Also want to thank Joshua, Dangerous Elysians, Stephen, Mint Condition, Sacagawea, Yair, 7,000 Somersaults from Home, Ryu, Promises of Oblivion, Dennis, Devastating Miscalculation, Byron, Drive Through Forgiveness. Thanks to everyone that donated
this
week.
Nicely done by you, Sam. And I also want to throw out a quick thank you to Lucy Kirchner in Chicago.
Yes.
She sent us a mixed CD of some of her favorite songs from 2006. Really appreciate that. And you mentioned Holly as well, getting a nickname there, a Gold Club member. She sent us a really nice note.
Lavender Royalty.
So, yeah, Lavender Royalty. So we really do appreciate all the support from our listeners. Thank you.
Hey Ed and Sam, this is Kate from UIUC, and the film I'm most looking forward to this spring is Hot Fuzz, because after Space and Shaun of the Dead, I'll go see anything Simon Pegg and Nick Frost put out. Thanks.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and we got a nice voicemail there from Kate in UIUC. Of course, that's Urbana-Champaign, not Chicago, like I said on last week's show. Right. And her number one most anticipated film of the spring is Hot Fuzz. The people she mentioned, Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, the guys behind Shaun of the Dead. We'll get into that film a little bit here later in this segment, coming up pretty quick, actually. But also wanted to mention another voicemail we got from a listener, Renee, I believe, in Austin. He mentioned the two films he was most looking forward to, Zodiac and 300, the Frank Miller graphic novel adaptation. I know Sam is dying to see because he loves Sin City so much, right?
Yeah, Sin City as well, based on a Frank Miller graphic novel, a film that actually, if you're a longtime listener, you'll remember it as the first film Adam and I vehemently disagreed for just about the entire year of 2005. I can't say I'm looking forward to this adaptation either, although Zack Snyder, the director of 300, is a director I think I'm curious about.
Okay.
Directed this remake of Dawn of the Dead that was well received. I'm curious.
Okay, so we're going to get into one of those films here in our top five. One of the two we mentioned, Zodiac or 300. You can guess which one it might be. But let's go ahead and do this list, Sam. And we decided that we were going to kind of break it down into two lists, our personal list and then this one kind of list that I'm calling the no-brainers, the big five. These are the five movies that everyone listening to the show is going to be familiar with by the time
whether they
come
out. Whether they want to see
them or not. Whether you want to see them or not, you're going to be familiar with them. You've probably already heard a lot about them. And we agree they're the five we're most really dying to see. So these are movies that we have high expectations for. And in all but one case, these are movies, like I said, that you're going to hear a lot about coming in. And I think the one example where you're maybe not going to hear a ton about it going in is our number five choice, and that is Hot Fuzz, the film that Kate mentioned, opens April 20th. And it is the Shaun of the Dead team, Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost. It opened last weekend in the UK and in Ireland. It was number one film at the box office, had the fifth biggest opening for a comedy in the UK ever. You've got Pegg and Frost starring in it, plus Jim Broadbent, who's great, Steve Coogan, who we love, Timothy Dalton, the former Bond, is in it.
Paddy Considine.
Yeah, Paddy Considine, who we love. It's the story of
Martin
two cops.
Martin Freeman from The British Office.
That's right.
I mean,
two cops,
stuff,
this sleepy little village where a bunch of brutal murders occur. And we loved Shaun of the Dead, or at least I love Shaun of the Dead, and this ability on their part to mix genres, to be funny with a zombie movie and here with kind of a traditional cop movie.
Yeah, buddy
maybe.
Cop movie, kind of. Yeah, the subversive kind of sense of humor.
Really
yeah.
looking forward to that film.
Yeah, the other one on our list, a film actually we got a chance to see at its world premiere at Sundance. It's Black Snake Moan. Comes out on March 2nd, so that's next week, actually. Craig Brewer's follow-up to Hustle and Flow with Samuel L. Jackson and Christina Ricci. Ricci is a nymphomaniac. Samuel L. Jackson is this lapsed blues musician who makes it his goal to save her in some way. We saw it. We loved it.
We did.
We can't wait to hear what everyone else has to say about it.
That's true. We were already at Sundance anticipating the negative responses from our listeners, trying to figure out exactly what would be
the
said about it.
Exploitation redemption picture.
And we will talk a little bit more about it next week. And, of course, if you want to go back and listen to our Sundance shows, you can hear my interview with Craig Brewer. Number three on our list is Zodiac, opens March 2nd. David Fincher film. his take on the Zodiac murders that occurred in Northern California in the late 60s and 70s. You got this cast that I am curious about, always interested in, Robert Downey Jr., Jake Gyllenhaal as the guys, one a journalist, one a cop, I believe, who are the people trying to solve this case. And I love David Fincher. That's the bottom line here. So anything he does, especially when he's able to take a movie like Zodiac, a serial killer movie, and maybe find ways to twist it on its head a little bit, maybe in ways that audiences don't necessarily like,
sure.
I'm curious to see that.
And we should note, interestingly, it was the most one of the most anticipated films of the year last year as well.
And it got pushed back.
Kind of pushed back out
of
2006.
And that doesn't deter me a bit in my love for it.
I agree. I totally agree. All right. Number two here, really, really obvious. It is Spider-Man 3. Director Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire's back, Kirsten Dunst. And I have to say, if there's one additional part that makes me excited
about it,
I know
where you're going.
Topher Grace. I love it that he's involved in this kind of project. And I think, everyone's familiar with it. I really liked the second one a lot more than the first even. So I have to say, I'm really excited about this too.
The third one looks like it should be the best of the three, and I don't want to put too much
I've still got Go Get Him Tiger, though, ringing in my ear from Spider-Man 2.
This concept of exploring the dark side of Spider-Man, I think, could be interesting. It made me even like the last Star Wars movie, Sam, as you'll famously recall. So I think that could really be great. And let's get on now to our number one pick, the most anticipated spring movie.
It was called The Grindhouse. Theaters that played back-to-back movies featuring uncensored sexuality and hardcore thrills. Now, Tarantino and Rodriguez are bringing The Grindhouse back. With two explosive feature films.
And that, of course, is Grindhouse. Really a double feature. Two films, one directed by Robert Rodriguez, making a film called Planet Terror with his great cast as Christina Ricci in it, and then Tarantino making his B-movie drive-in knockoff called
70s exploitation.
Yeah, the 70s exploitation film with Kurt Russell, who I love going back to Escape from New York and a lot of films.
Snake Plissken.
Snake Plissken. So putting those two guys together, letting them just explore the things that they love, the things that got them into cinema. You know, it's interesting because I think we'll talk about this when we review it. We're not the kind of people that would typically go to those kind of films and enjoy it. So how are we going to enjoy this film? Are we going to enjoy it only on that kind of meta level of, oh, look at how they're aping the conventions of those
films? Right, because we're not familiar with what they're aping.
We wouldn't go to that.
Knowing Tarantino, I don't think that's going to be a deterrent at all. I can't say that I'm as excited about the Rodriguez portion of the film, but I take Tarantino at his word where he was quoted as saying, this is my next film. This is my next feature-length film. I mean, this is not something he's just thrown off on the cuff. So
yeah, okay. Well, we are obviously looking forward to that. Our number one pick, and now we're getting on to our more personal list. These are what we're already calling maybe the overlooked top five of the spring. These are films that, unlike the last five we mentioned, we don't have tremendously high expectations going in, but we're very curious about. And the fact is, they could be complete disasters or they could be incredible.
Yeah, they could be overlooked by us.
That's true.
When it comes to
them. They could be. So let's go ahead and get into my number five. Let's hear a clip.
I shot her.
Shot your wife?
I got the gun. I shot her in the head.
Be careful with this guy. There's something not right about him.
I go in there with a signed confession, and I put this guy in jail.
All right. I'm from the district attorney's office.
You look closely enough, you'll find everything has a weak spot where it can break. Sooner or later.
You're looking for mine.
I've already found yours.
And that is the trailer for Fracture, a movie that opens April 27th, a movie I just saw the trailer for last night at the theater, Sam, actually. It's a cat-and-mouse game between a DA and a guy who kills his wife and seems to have it all planned out in order to get away with it. You've got Ryan Gosling as the DA, Anthony Hopkins as the way-too-smart killer, and I'm worried about Gosling's accent. I'm worried about the fact that the whole thing seems to have a little bit too much Keanu Reeves, devil's advocate, lawyer on the rise, too ambitious, getting caught up in something that's kind of over his head. But you've got Anthony Hopkins, of course, another great actor along with Gosling, who's kind of reprising his Hannibal Lecter part along with the guy from The Edge, this genius from The Edge. David Strathairn's also in it. And if I can be a pig for just a second, I'm sorry, Rosamund Pike is in the film. Jane Bennett from Pride and Prejudice. She's just stunning. She plays Gosling's love interest. I think she might be the sexiest actress in movies. I'm saying that right now. I've been in love with her ever since she was the good Bond girl.
We're lining up now already.
That's right,
for Fracture.
In Die Another Day. And again, the movie could just be terrible. It could be, in some ways, the devil's advocate without Pacino. Grandstanding is Satan, of course. But based on the cast, it does look like a pretty interesting thriller.
Yeah, I'm sort of responding to your number five here. Gosling, obviously, a discovery for me, gave one of the best performances of 2006 in Half Nelson. Here are two other young actors starring in two films that don't look very good. I'll be honest. I have to say these weren't films we'd go out of our way to see in most cases. They are The Lookout and Disturbia, one of the worst titles for a film. That says a void right there, a film called Disturbia. The Lookout, I'll start with that, stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, of course, one of our favorites from Brick last year. This film, written and directed by Scott Frank, who wrote Get Shorty.
Out of Sight,
and also The Interpreter, which I've forgiven him for. I'm actually blaming Steven Zalian for The Interpreter.
Okay.
He's getting all the blame for that. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think he has maybe the steeper hill to climb in terms of convincing me to go see this film. He plays a mentally disturbed janitor in a bank heist movie. The Lookout, we'll see. The next film is Disturbia, starring Shia LaBeouf, another young actor who was in Bobby, in The Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, gave two really good performances there. He is starring in this film, Disturbia, another kind of thriller, upset about the death of his father. He becomes sullen and withdrawn and troubled. He becomes convinced that his next-door neighbor is a serial killer. Not promising, I'm saying that right now, about both films, but two young actors I'm curious about, like Ryan Gosling and Fracture. None of these films look stunning, but we'll see if the actors can pull it off.
Yeah, and I do believe that you actually may be wanting to blame Sidney Pollack, not Steven Zalian, for The Interpreter.
There's a lot of blame.
There is a lot of blame. You're still blaming Steven Zalian for all the King's Men, aren't you, Sam?
Well, actually, Scott Frank, actually, I heard him kind of apologize for The Interpreter. He actually said, you know what, I came in as maybe the fifth writer there. I didn't do that film any favors. I haven't heard Steven Zalian say that.
That's true. Okay, well, let's get on to my number four here, and it is the film The Wind That Shakes the Barley from Ken Loach, won the Palme d'Or in 2006. Cannes Film Festival, Cillian Murphy stars in it. It's a film set in 1919, the Irish Civil War. Two brothers join these guerrilla armies, and they're battling the British, who are trying to obviously keep Ireland from attaining independence. The fact that it won at Cannes, the fact that it's Ken Loach, Cillian Murphy is a guy I'm very curious about. So I'm interested to see the film, see if it lives up to the Cannes hype.
Yeah, I'm interested in it, too. It's my number four as well. The kind of prestige picture I'm kind of grateful for this time of year. Not a lot of great, great stuff coming out. Will it be uplifting? Not likely.
No.
I looked up the poem the title is based on, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Not a happy poem.
Depressing.
I'll tell you
right
there. It probably will be depressing, but I think it'll probably be really effective. Cillian Murphy, too. Another really interesting actor. Looking forward to that film.
Yep. Okay. Well, my number three is a film that comes out limited March 23rd. It's called Color Me Kubrick, and it's this true story of this guy named Alan Conway who, while Kubrick was filming Eyes Wide Shut in London, passed himself off in high society London as Kubrick, this reclusive director, and he could do it even though he didn't look or sound anything like Kubrick because nobody knows really what Kubrick, for the most part, looks and sounds like, and it's got Malkovich in it.
Yeah.
And so it even sounds like being John Malkovich in some ways, maybe not as whimsical as, you know, a film from Spike Jones, but certainly it has that kind of edge to it. And with Malkovich playing the role, I'm really dying to see it.
All right, March 23rd, Rain Over Me comes out, directed by Mike Binder, starring Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle. It's Adam Sandler in a serious role. He plays this this man who lost his family on September 11th, runs into this old college roommate played by Cheadle. I thought Adam Sandler was so, so good in Punch Drunk Love, one of my favorite films from recent years. I'm willing to overlook the fact that Binder is responsible for this. He was responsible for The Upside of Anger, a film from 2005 I just thought was really bad, and managed to let Joan Allen, the great Joan Allen, give a bad performance, I thought. So we'll see. I'm still looking forward to it. Don Cheadle, Adam Sandler. Looks like it could be good.
Okay, I am curious about that film as well, and I'll get into my last two choices quickly here. Number two, Southland Tales, comes out in April. I don't know that there's a date set, but this is the Richard Kelly film. And I don't know how interesting a film sounds that has six different parts and has as its three main stars, as far as I understand, The Rock, Sean William Scott, and Sarah Michelle Gellar. Talk about a murderer's row. But then you add in that it is from the writer-director of Donnie Darko, his follow-up to that. I will go see anything Richard Kelly does. It was the first major kind of blowout disagreement among critics at Cannes. 160 minutes. Andrew O'Hare from Salon calls it this apocalyptic opus. And a few critics seemed to like it. A lot of people walked out of it. They thought it was so bad. He's trimmed like a half an hour from it, and they're still working on it. So, you know, it could be, again, a total disaster, but it's Richard Kelly, so I'm curious, and that brings me to my number one. It is the film Rescue Dawn, March 30th, in limited release. This is the film with Christian Bale, Steve Zahn, two actors we love, and of course, directed by Werner Herzog. After our Herzog marathon, how can you not want to see this film? Again, another movie that you just don't know which way to go with it. I've heard critics talk about it, seeing it at one screening, being like, oh my God, this film is terrible. Other people seem to think it has Oscar written all over it, that it's this masterpiece. And with Herzog, you just know
that
it could be either one.
Really
you just
be.
Don't know. So the story itself is fascinating, too. Herzog already made a documentary about it, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Bale plays this guy who, born in Germany, and he comes over to America and wants to be a pilot and gets shot down in Vietnam and then escapes into the jungle, and it's even worse, of course.
The battle
it's Herzog.
With nature, yeah.
It's even worse in the jungle than it is when he was a prisoner. So Rescue Dawn, can't wait to see that film.
Yeah, end of March, hopefully we will see that. It's my number one as well, but I will sneak in a number two here. It's my Idiocracy pick of 2007. Last year, I did look forward to Idiocracy, and I think it did pay off. This is my sort of 2007 Luke Wilson film nobody will probably see but me pick, The Wendell Baker Story, directed by Luke and his brother, Andrew Wilson. Let me just quickly read the synopsis.
It sounds so bad.
Wilson plays a lifetime criminal who gets a job at a retirement community upon release from prison, makes friends with residents played by Seymour Cassell, Harry Dean Stanton, and Kris Kristofferson, the evil head nurse, played by Owen Wilson, Owen's right-hand man, played by Eddie Griffin. How can this go wrong?
Eddie Griffin is how it can go wrong.
Well, I'll tell you how it probably has gone wrong. You look on IMDb, this movie is listed as a 2005 picture.
Uh-huh.
This movie has been sticking around for a while. I guarantee you I will recommend this film.
I guarantee it.
No one else
will
like it. This is going to be a goldmine of laughs.
Okay, well, there you go. We just gave you 13 to 15 films to be excited about over the next 3 months or so. We did, of course, count spring as leading up to June by the end of Memorial Day. I know some people think of Spider-Man probably being a summer movie, but that was our criterion there. So
that's right.
Opening in wide release this weekend, The Abandoned, The Astronaut Farmer with Billy Bob Thornton, Reno 911 Miami, and Jim Carrey in The Number 23, which despite the fact that it's directed by Joel Schumacher, I am actually very interested in seeing, and we'll either review The Number 23 or, as we said earlier, we might have an early review of Zodiac, the David Fincher film, so stay tuned for that.
Thanks to Milwaukee's The Dark Horse Project for today's music. More information is available at thedarkhorseproject.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Support for Film Spotting is provided by PeerFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. More information is available at peerflix.com or at filmspotting.net.